Profile Interview.
15 minutes after 9 o'clock, and my guest is Chief Executive Officer for the Insurance Sector Education and Training Authority. Her name is Gugu Mkhize, and she's here with me in the studio. Just Gugu, thank you so much for coming to join me this evening.
Good evening, Aubrey. Thank you for having me.
So I don't know what Ntating did, but we have to have this. It's wonderful to have a guest on this particular day when you could have been elsewhere.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for coming through. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're the CEO of Inseta, the Insurance Sector Education and Training Authority. What is that?
So the Insurance Sector Education and Training Authority is one of the 21 CETAs which are responsible for skills development in the insurance industry. So we facilitate skills development through learnerships, bursaries, skills programs, but we also support small businesses to grow and build their businesses. And also we work a lot with our delivery partners. So we don't do the training ourselves, but we work with delivery partners like higher education institutions, the TVET colleges, as well as the employers to run the training programs to literally just grow the sector and also build capacity and skills for the current and future needs.
So when you say the sector, the insurance sector, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I look bright, but I'm really thick as two planks, right? So I'm going to ask you questions that might seem, what the hell is this guy talking about? What are CETAs?
So CETAs were set up for each sector to specifically focus on building a pipeline of the skills in their respective industries.
Right.
So the 21 CETAs, they focus on different sectors. You've got Inseta, which focuses in the insurance sector. You've got other CETAs that focus on their own respective sector. It could be agriculture, wholesale and retail. It could be food and beverage, the mining CETA. But all our mandate focuses really on building the pipeline of
skills.
Yes.
So I imagine some clever people sat down somewhere and they said, listen, the engine industries or sectors in this country are these 21. And then an agreement somewhere was made that we were going to create these CETAs, and one of them, of course, being the Inseta. Give me the genesis of it all.
Okay.
Where did it start?
So the skills development landscape in South Africa is anchored on the Skills Development Act. So we are entities that report to the Department of Higher Education, Science and Innovation, and the CETAs were established as far back as 1996, and they were at some point 25, and then they were merged to 23, and now we've got 21 CETAs. But the focus really is, like I'm saying, the building the pipeline of skills, but also looking at the current trends and what is changing in the industry, the technological influence, and all the other issues like climate change, how technology is impacting various industries, and how we can grow the economy and contribute meaningfully to the economy.
The insurance sector, I mean, the moment I hear somebody speak about that, I feel this pang of grudge. Because you probably appreciate this, that the insurance sector is a much needed sector, but one we pay begrudgingly, and are very, very unhappy about the payments we make towards whatever insurance it is that we've got, until the problem that insurance has been purchased for actually arises and that insurance pays out. So I think we have a love-hate relationship with the insurance sector. What are the skills that should typically be developed by your CETA?
So we've got a top 10 scarce and critical skills list, which is reviewed on an annual basis. And some of these skills obviously include the actuaries. You've got compliance.
Izangom. Somebody was explaining to me that the one time what actuaries do.
Yeah.
And And I don't understand what they do, but it sounded almost like these are like fortune tellers of some sort, yeah? Using numbers and all sorts of stuff like that. So every time somebody says to me, actuaries, it just, you know, comes up like that.
But Izangoma.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so obviously we can call them Izangoma there too.
Yeah.
And then also you've got risk officers who deal with risk compliance officers. And also, interestingly, technology plays a critical role in the insurance industry. So you've got your program developers, data analysts. Those are some of the skills which are in the top 10 scarce and critical skills. Yeah.
Somebody's asking me now, why would you think that actuaries are Izangoma? I'm going to ask Sisgu to try and explain it, but I'll tell you from my perspective, I understood actuaries to be people who, through their brilliance in mathematics and scenario building and futurism, are able to create sort of patterns of how and what sort of risks insurance companies must expose themselves to if they are going to take your business.
Yeah.
Am I on the right track?
Yep, you are.
Tell me more. Tell me more a little bit about actuaries, because this person on the socials is saying, ah, there you go again, Obs. Hey, you and your stories. Okay, but tell us.
Yeah, so actuaries, like you're saying, they are obviously, they focused and they look at mathematical equations to predict the future and look at the risk, but also they show sort of different scenarios that where you can be able to invest and also look at what possibilities are there within the insurance industry in terms of growth. Yeah,
right. And of course, many other skills in that sector that need to make our insurance sector viable, functional, and perhaps on a par with the rest of the world. Is that the idea, to try and develop those kinds of skills?
Yes. So the interest is to develop skills that are globally recognized, but also skills that can be able to sustain the industry. You know that insurance industry by itself is pegged within the financial services sector. So within the financial services sector, you've got investment, you've got banking, and then you also have the insurance industry. So by itself, the industry is obviously aspiring to create skills that are globally competitive, but skills that help with building the industry and ensuring that it makes more in terms of contributing to the GDP of the country.
And who asks for these skills? I mean, does the industry look for skills that you guys help deliver? Mm. I mean, that you help deliver?
Yeah.
How does that relationship work?
So we've got planning tools that we use. So one of the planning tools that we use is the sector skills plan. So annually, we collect data from the industry that tells us the kind of skills that are required, long-term, medium-term, and short-term skills. And that is where we draw the information. But besides that, we also undertake research, which then informs us what are the kind of skills that are required. And like I indicated earlier on, there's a huge demand, or there's a surge when it comes to digital skills, your data analytics, 4IR skills in the industry. Talking about drone technology, I mean, you know the explosion that happened in Johannesburg, because you couldn't have human beings going underground to inspect what had happened. They had to use the drone. So those are some of the skills.
Really
that
practical stuff. Really practical stuff in that sector that people need to have in order to make decisions whether or not we repudiate claims or not.
Yes, yes.
It's that simple, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe not that simple, but conceptually, that is the issue here. That's the story. Okay.
Yeah.
Who pays for it?
So the skills development of the sector, of each sector, like I indicated, is paid for by industry. So we collect a percentage or with 1% of the levies from the industry based on their training or their salary bill of the industry. And that gets routed via SARS into the Department of Higher Education to the CETAs in terms of our how we collect the revenue to fund the skills development agenda of the insurance industry.
Is this working?
It is working.
I'm talking about this relationship between the industry, government, and the creation of this body, this thing called the CETA.
Yeah.
Is it producing the skills that are required? Is it really living up to its mandate?
Yeah. So it is responding to the needs, but we could be doing much, much better. So through collaborations, and as I indicated, we also engage a lot with the sector players who are at the coalface of these skills and who consume the specific skills that we produce. So that relationship has been working for, more than two decades in terms of the skills supply and demand. But obviously, as the sector is changing, there's a need to pick up the pace in terms of responding more prudently towards the alignment between the demand and the supply of the skills.
I imagine that as a CETA, you are insulated from undue pressure from the industry, even though they are paying for the gig. But you're insulated, I imagine, legislatively from their influence, which can be undue, I imagine, at some times. I'm interested to hear, how are you protected from the big guns? I mean, the people that have a lot of money, that have a big salary bill, that are contributing big money, in how the industry or the CETA finds skills that are equitable for the sector, rather than that are good for that particular client. If it makes sense. Does it make sense what I'm saying? Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah?
So planning helps us because then we are able to look at, remember, because we report, we are an entity that belongs to the Department of Higher Education and Training. We have a shareholder compact that we sign on an annual basis that gives us the marching orders in terms of what the targets, performance indicators should be. And these determine the programs that must be focused on at a national level. And what is interesting is that in our industry, we've got a very close relationship with our employers. So, and you would know the composition of the board also allows employers to sit in the board and contribute strategically in terms of what is the direction that the organization should be focusing on in terms of what skills should we be focusing on. So that planning process helps because it assist with driving the skills agenda at a broader level, but also at a strategic level rather than focusing on individual entities. And also the planning tools that we have helps us also to put every skill that's required into a repository and then plan accordingly in terms of knowing what is required and how do we then direct resources, limited resources, I must say, towards the skills.
But I imagine there are certain companies in this space that sometimes want to, because they're used to getting their way, they are powerful, they're big, they've got lots of money, they've got deep pockets, that would sometimes want certain things and agendas to serve their purposes. Does that ever happen?
To a limited extent. I think the relationship that we have has assisted us over the years to really manage our relationship with the employers. And I must say, also, we've got different sizes or categories of employers. We've got large, medium, and small. And this helps us because then we are able to engage meaningfully. Where there are requests for funding that's higher than what is available and what is affordable, we're able to engage openly and indicate to the specific entities in terms of what's affordable and what's not.
Do you guys ever get involved in industry spats. I mean, not too long ago, about a week or so ago, there was a whole thing with Old Mutual being accused of not paying a claim. Not too long ago, before that, Momentum was in trouble for not paying a particular claim. Very close to that time period, there was a family that literally brought the body of their loved one to an office. I think it was in KwaZulu-Natal somewhere. Just dropped it there and said, if you guys can't help us, we're gonna do you guys get involved in that kind of conversation sometimes?
No, we are. Obviously, there are regulatory bodies that regulate the insurance industry. So our focus and mandate is purely on the skills development front, not so much in that front, yeah.
But don't you then create the kind of individuals who have the skills to be able to comment on the ebbs and flows of this industry, to be able to say that this kind of behavior is good, bad, or indifferent?
Look, in the strictest sense of the word, in terms of our involvement on issues happening, technical issues happening in the industry, like I'm saying, there are professional bodies, there are also regulatory bodies to which the insurance industry is accountable to. Our role is to make sure that we've got the relevant and right skills, but it doesn't bar us from having a particular opinion about a matter or matters happening within the insurance industry.
Do you air them sometimes?
Not necessarily.
I suppose it could be career limiting at some point.
No, have to protect the industry.
Let's talk a little bit about how big is the budget for the creation of these skills. Per annum, for example.
Okay, so in the previous financial year, I can just give you an example of the previous financial year. I think we had more than 600 million.
Really?
For driving the skills agenda for the industry. And this is split between two parts. There's a mandatory grant. So the industry will train and claim a percentage of what they have invested in terms of the training. And then there's discretionary grants, which is where your bursaries, your skills programs, learnerships and internships then will be funded. Yeah.
So I love the conversation about education in South Africa. One of the things that really, really gets me deeply worried is the fact that we find that our institutions of higher learning are producing qualified students. They have the credentials, they have the degrees, they have the diplomas, and then they can't find work. And one of the big questions I always ask is the relationship that academia has with industry. Is industry, which is closer to the tar, right, to the practical realities of this business, informing academia of what is needed, and to what extent do you guys play a role in that process?
Yeah, so you would know, Aubrey, that currently there's a transition from legacy qualifications into occupational qualifications.
Right.
And the reason for that, I think, at a national level, is to address exactly that, the relationship or the linkage between industry and what the institutions of higher learning are producing. Barring from specific technical qualifications, you are correct. There's a lot of young people who are sitting in the street corners with degrees who are qualified, but they can't find work because there's a mismatch between what they have acquired versus what various industries are requiring. And it requires that close proximity between industries and academic institutions in terms of developing skills that are responding directly to the industries the skills are required.
What did you say? Legacy qualifications versus?
Occupational qualifications.
Tell me more about that. What does that mean?
So the occupational qualifications are the qualifications that would give you practical experience as well as theoretical know-how. Some of the qualifications offered at university, by the way, like your engineering, sure, already have that aspect, that aspect of that theoretical knowledge as well as mandatory practical work that gives you the opportunity to go into a workplace and get experience. A lot of the young people who struggle, who I have interacted with, will say to me, I can't find work because I don't have experience. But unless the structure of our education system responds to this by allowing young people to get into programs like your internships and be able to gain experience, they won't have, and they are not in a position to get practical experience.
And is that what INSITA does? Provide those internships?
Yes.
Help the relationship between the young person and the industry? Is that what you guys do?
Yes.
How exactly does that happen?
Yeah, so internships are offered to young people to give them work experience and work exposure. But the part of what we also do is work readiness, which prepares a young person from the time when they have completed the qualification, that bridge between them being placed into the workplace and the time when they've completed their qualification, because you find that they've got this qualification, but they are not ready.
They're not,
and
sure,
they don't understand what the work environment is all about.
Oh, that is so.
So we give them opportunities for preparing them for the world of work before they get placed into these programs, the internship programs.
Give me the numbers. I mean, how many young people do you have to process a year?
Okay, so last year alone, we were able to, I mean, we have a total of about 13,000 beneficiaries across all our programs. And out of those 13,500, about 65% are unemployed young people, some of whom have already been able to get employment in the insurance industry.
Are you finding that you are a relevant catchment sort of platform for youngsters that are looking for opportunities in the sector, but are, without your assistance, would probably not get those opportunities?
Yes. One of our biggest drives currently, I think over the last 3 years, has been to implement programs in the rural areas, because you'd know that the insurance industry, by its architecture, is based in cities. So we have got a deliberate strategy for supporting young people coming from rural areas, from townships, to participate in our programs. Yeah.
Wow. Why did you get into this business? Why did Gugu Mkhize decide to get into this business? It sounds like, I mean, of the 21 seaters, how many of those seaters are led by women?
I think more than 50%.
Really?
Are being led by women. Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
I think the Minister of Higher Education has done very well, Dr. Blade Nzimande, in appointing women and affirming women, and a lot of them are young women, yeah, who are doing very well.
How did you get into this?
So before I was appointed as a CEO for the insurance in CETA. I was working for one of the CETAs as an executive, which was the mining CETA. So that's how I got involved in the CETA, but specifically higher education. I've always been involved in higher education because I used to work at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Then it was called Durban Westville. I think I spent my formative career there for about 9 years before moving to other.
So you're an academic. You weren't necessarily like a hardcore business person when you came into all of this. You came from an academic sort of background.
Yes.
Okay.
But then I found my way into a property investment and infrastructure fund, which was a subsidiary of Itala Bank, the KZN Growth Fund. And then after that, I then moved into a property and development entity, which is one of the subsidiaries of the city of Johannesburg. So I wouldn't call myself as an academic because I was in the administration part of the university, not so much the academic. Yeah.
Right. How long have you been in this business as CEO? How long have you been CEO?
I was appointed in 2020, December.
So it's 4 years, right?
Almost, yes.
Why do you think you've stayed?
I think the tenacity is what has kept me, but also I think authenticity. For me, I believe my leadership is very authentic and empowering to the people that I work with, or to the team that I work with, and that is what has sustained me. But also, I think I'm strong, yet soft. I hold people accountable, but also I allow people the space to work and do what they do best.
I'm finding, and somebody will probably take me on this, but I'm finding that there is a style of leadership that is quintessentially female that is getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll tell you what I mean by that. I liked what you said, that I'm strong but soft. Mm. Yeah, that while I look for accountability, I'm also encouraging. Right. Mm. So I find that there is a type of leadership that I can only call a feminine type of leadership that seems to be getting over the egotistical issues that arise as a result of very hardcore, you will do this. Mm. If you don't, we're going to fire you kind of thing. Mm. There seems to be a leadership that is feminine. And by the way, by saying so, I'm saying that there are certain men who exhibit those kinds of leadership qualities. Mm. Mm. But generally, and in most cases, I'm seeing it amongst women leaders who are leading organizations of whatever variety, whatever type. But there is very much that I'm strong, but I'm soft kind of thing. Mm. To which I think teams respond very, very positively.
Mm.
But it's something that these women leaders can't say to me that they learned at a particular university or at a particular college. Where does that thing come from?
I think it's exposure. It's exposure. So in my career, maybe half of my career, I can say all my strength and the strongness of my career and the firmness, I would have taken some of those character traits from males, because for the past four positions that I've held, I've worked with male CEOs. And the softness, I can say it's something that would have come from the networks that I've built with strong women, but also women who were very deliberate in wanting to ensure that they don't lose who they are.
Right.
So that's why I talk about authenticity, because for me, what gets the work done is not the loudness of your voice. What gets the work done is collaboratively getting people to understand this is the direction we're going, and getting people to fall into line and also buy into your vision. They don't buy into your vision because you're screaming on top of your voice, but they buy into your leadership because they understand clearly what your vision is.
So clarity is a big issue.
Absolutely.
Do you get people that test you?
A lot.
What do you do to them?
So I think in any position, you'll always have people that will try to test your limits, try to push you. And I think my experience has taught me that you have to allow people to be who they are, but also understand the corporate environment and where we're working. So we're driving a big project currently in the organization, and we're calling it Project Excellence. We've even developed a model around it in terms of creating standards for ourselves to say these are the standards we want to be held accountable for in terms of our delivery time, response time, and how do we get things done. So if you set the standards and they're universal across the board, anyone that goes below those standards or performs below those standards, there's already consequences for that.
And people, everybody knows these standards, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So that nobody can say, listen, I didn't know.
Yes,
so,
yes.
So part of the work, I imagine, is really making sure that everybody is on the same page. Everybody understands what these standards are.
Yes, but also appreciation, Aubrey. One of the things is when people exceed the standards that you have set, you need to appreciate them.
So you don't say,
and publicly we're not gonna acknowledge that they're doing well.
So you don't say we're not gonna praise a fish for swimming.
If they are meeting the standards,
yes,
it means they are swimming.
Right.
But if they are doing more and they are going over and beyond their call of duty, then obviously you have to appreciate people. You have to also tell people that you're on the right track and keep clapping for them until they get to the finish line. Otherwise, it just looks like we, as leaders, we keep taking and taking and taking from our teams and never really show appreciation.
What you learned from your male counterparts and perhaps mentors and so forth, people that you worked with, the CEOs, and what you learned from the networks, typically mean that you've got two attributes, and I know there's more, but basically two attributes that work together in you to produce the kinds of results that you want in your management style, in your leadership.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still happening in Kukumkize. All of this stuff is happening in Kukumkize.
Yeah.
Many people have mentors who are male.
Yes.
And networks. But they can't run organizations like a Kukumkize does that.
Mm.
What is it about Kukumkize that has been able to synthesize these attributes in this very unique way that produces the leadership that is uniquely Kukumkize? What is it about you and your interpretation of all of this that has made you the leader you are?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things, but one of them for me is the brand Gugu is synonymous with excellence. I believe that, like I'm saying, when you talk about excellence to people or to the team, and they don't know what the definition of that is and what the standard is of that excellence, it's easy to just say, oh, okay, she's talking about excellence. But once you demonstrate that through people you can achieve excellence, through the strategy of the organization you can achieve excellence, and through creating effective systems and being able to bring all the pieces together, you're able to drive the excellence, then people are like, oh, this is what is meant by excellence, because it doesn't happen in a vacuum. So I believe for me, one of the critical things is defining what excellence is for me. I've defined it throughout my career, not now. I've started defining it many years ago to say, this is the standard I want to hold myself to.
Do you believe in black excellence?
I do. I am an example of black excellence.
I ask this question because it's become a very, very heated debate. There are those people who say that the idea of black excellence is actually quite demeaning.
Mm-hmm.
Because excellence is excellence.
Mm.
But to speak of black excellence is to almost relegate oneself to a secondary level of excellence,
mm-hmm,
that is manufactured by circumstances. Your thoughts?
So excellence for me is about a particular person defining those standards for themselves. What does excellence mean for me? It transcends race. It transcends gender. It's about you defining, if I am doing something, these are the standards, minimum standards, that I will not go below because I want to achieve this excellence. If it happens to me, because of the color, just because of the color of my skin. It's not because there's a magic wand that anyone has pulled. It's because I have set myself up to be able to perform at that level and also deliver in terms of my role and be able to achieve the things that I've been able to do. Just last year, as an example, our organization received 5 awards, 2 of which are global awards, by the way, and 3 of which,
you know,
just saying.
Yeah.
So and 3 of those are specifically about myself and my leadership, the public sector
sure.
leader from the Standard Bank, top empowerment, the global leader, which is coming from one of the global entities. So what I'm saying is, before people buy into your excellence and who you are, you have to buy into it yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And define it.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in KZN. In a semi-rural area called Gwanqeto. Other people will call it Embo. And then later on, the family moved into Suburbia. But yeah, that's where I grew up.
Part of what is intriguing about your story is precisely that you grew up in a semi-rural space. You were able to imbibe certain cultural values that are about humility, that are about respect of the elders, that are about the respect of certain gender roles, I imagine, mm-hmm. that are about the respect of history, ancestry, faith, and so forth. But you've managed to carve a niche, almost aggressively so, in a space that many people that would have come from your formative sort of
mm-hmm.
upbringing would have said, how did that happen?
Yeah.
Where did that value of irreverence for irrelevant ideas come from?
So I come from a very strong lineage of strong women and strong men. My grandmother was an entrepreneur.
There's always an entrepreneur somewhere, yep. Yeah.
She was an entrepreneur, and at the age of 80, she was still selling. And also, my mother, the story of my mother is very interesting. She got married and went back to school after getting married with 2 kids. And went to college to become, a teacher's college.
And there's always a teacher, eh?
Yes, and she emphasized the whole, she had a lot of great emphasis on education and people becoming better through education. So I come from that background, but also the value system of respect. I think my late dad used to say to me every time when he heard that I had gotten an executive position years ago, he would say, "Mtanam,
baphathe kahle abantu,"
meaning treat people.
Yeah,
you must treat people well.
Yeah.
So all those words continuously ring in my head because I think when people see your humility, your humanness, they are able to identify with you, and
relate.
When you correct them. You correct them respectfully, and when you have to hold them accountable, they can see that you are relating to them at a human level rather than at a CEO subordinate level.
I find that every time I speak to executives like yourself, CEOs, that there's that component of knowing who you are, where you come from, and really, really, really internalizing it. For the reasons that you've just explained now, that you're relatable, that when you are correcting people, you are not doing it from a credential point of view, but from a human point of view who is leading a particular purpose. I get that.
Mm.
I get that. But I'm beginning to hear this golden thread amongst all of the CEOs that I've interviewed or had conversations with, that unless you know yourself, unless there's a very deep understanding of who you are, it is very difficult to then lead. Do you find that to be the case?
Absolutely. I think self-mastery is a key.
Ah.
When you don't know yourself, you find yourself projecting
something else.
Something that you're completely not, and trying to assimilate or copy the next person. Or speaking like a particular person that maybe you look up to. But if you know who you are, it helps you to really find yourself in the position, because finding yourself in any leadership position requires you to, first of all, understand what are the things that make me great? What are the things that are my blind spots? How do I overcome those blind spots? Who are the people that I need to immediately get in touch with when I see that this blind spot is actually going to lead me into a ditch? And those are people that could either be your peers or people that are your mentors that can help you. So the leadership journey and how you master who you are is not necessarily an intrinsic thing where it's about yourself, but it's about looking for help outside of yourself on those areas where you are weak, but also being able to flaunt the things that you do very well for people to see and be able to find themselves in you and see themselves that, oh, she actually does this very well. I could learn a thing or two from this person.
It is possible, yeah.
Yes.
What has been your greatest or your deepest disappointment?
In my career or just personally?
And I'm not looking for an incident. I'm looking for a principle, a thing that you were just disappointed by.
Let me think about that.
Okay. What has been your greatest and most uplifting experience?
I think my job is very uplifting, in that I get to change people's lives and touch people's lives coming from different walks of life. I just came back from one of our project site visits today, and I met young people whose stories are very inspiring to me as well, who come from very disadvantaged backgrounds, but they're saying they want to see themselves better. They want to see their lives getting better through education, and they are pursuing their passion, and they want to get into the insurance industry. So for me, I think that is what lifts me up, seeing that the work that we do or the work that I contribute to what's doing is changing people's lives in the real sense of the word.
Dr. Philemon Mahuna is listening to our conversation, and he says, what a masterclass on leadership. And he says, thanks, Obs and 702. But it's more thank you to Kukum Kize, who is the CEO of INSETA, the Insurance Sector Education and Training Authority. What is the one thing that you think has defined you as a person and as a leader? What lesson? Where did that come from?
I think my faith is what defines me. I think my identity, I can't find words to describe or define myself outside of God. So I think my faith is what defines, and it's a basis of everything that I do.
Your faith?
Yes.
So what are you doing this Easter period?
It's church time.
Come on now.
It's church time.
Get some church up in here. All right. It's been an absolute honor talking to you. I'm supremely proud of you.
Thank you.
Wonderful talking to you. Kukum Kize is the CEO of the Insurance Sector Education and Training Authority.